And by the way, Predrag is from Georgia Tech.
Thank you. And I'm very grateful to the organizers for, you know, bringing all these amazing people together and making it possible for me to do this to you, what I will just now do. I might be tired and feathered after the talk, but so far. So what I would like to do, I mean, it will look a little bit strange and in a mathematics institute, but not very many formulas, it won't look very serious. But it's a very sort of ambitious and long program, and I'm hoping to learn a few things from people here. We have lots of technical problems, not just conceptual problems, and maybe you can help us. So one of the things that I've been engaged in many, many years, and you know, I don't see the end of it yet, is how to deal with strongly nonlinear field theories, and you know, both classical and quantum. So to put it in some kind of very simple way, for people who have some experience in quantum field theory, you know, a typical quantum field theoretical problem is some multiplet, let's say. There are quarks which have colors and spinor indices, and they have a spatio-temporal dependence in Minkowski space. There are gauge fields, and then there is an action which describes the theory, gives all the equations of motion, which has, you know, gauge fields, and then which are self-coupled. And then there's a coupling between photons or gluons with quarks. And, you know, the theory is very beautiful and very easy to write down. So it's been written down by many people, but it can be summarized by saying, you know, there's some partition function which contains all the answers that you can extract from quantum field theory or from statistical mechanics. And that's the path integral, all possible field configurations. And, you know, all you have to do is add up the phases. So you compute action for each field configuration. There's a little H bar and I saying that this is quantum field theory. And we don't actually know how to do this very well. And, you know, in my opinion, we don't know how to do it almost at all. The best answers we have today in quantum field theory are done by Monte Carlo simulations on lattices, and they're, you know, they're very hard to execute, they're very hard to understand what the results mean, and I'm not sure they're even correct. But now, one thing that's been very fruitful, and the reason why I picked this topic for this meeting, is to think semi-classically, because, you know, we have extremely good experience from a century of quantum mechanics, where classical ideas plus a little bit of H bar get us a very, very long way. So proposal that I would like to discuss here and tell you, you know, what we know and what we would like to know is to say, well, you know, when you have an integral like this, you should find the stationary phase solutions to this integral. By now, you know, having been exposed to Gutzwiller's theory of in quantum mechanics, we know that we expect lots, you know, infinity of these solutions, these saddles, and then each one of them, you know, has some quantum action associated with it. It might have some geometrical phase factors, and if it's done well, we might be able to compute higher order H corrections, not just leading semi-classical term. And then each solution, you know, because you basically do a Gaussian integral to get from here to there, each solution has a weight which has to do with second derivatives of the action. And in practice, this is rather painful, but, you know, this is what it looks like. So there are lots of them. The more unstable ones are less important, that's encoded here. And, you know, there's lots of classical mechanics in this, and there's some, you know, wave mechanics, and there's some quantum mechanics in this. And now we know how to do this fairly successfully in many quantum mechanical problems. You know, since 1971 or so, when Gutzwiller formulated this kind of theory, lots of people, you know, many of them in this room, have contributed, and it works quite well. And you know, when it doesn't work, we know what to think about, etc. Now, what I'm proposing here is in case of a field theory, you're supposed to understand the classical field theory better than we know now. And the intuition is that because it's a strongly nonlinear coupled field theory, let's say like Navier-Stokes for the intuition is that they should have very complicated dynamics. They should have some kind of turbulent classical dynamics. And then to make it, you know, full quantum theory, this comes in, but then there'll be tunneling effects, there'll be diffraction effects, there'll be more stuff, and it still might not be good enough. So this is just a proposal, and where it's going to work is not obvious. So now I want to emphasize that this proposal is not what one tends to do in field theory when it says, you know, there are these harmonic degrees of freedom, you know, electrons and photons. So you can think of it as the free particles, and then they interact. It's absolutely not that. You know, solutions don't look anything like that. And it's not, you know, the first non-perturbative stab at quantum field theory where you have instanton solutions, or you have non-trivial, but, you know, incountable infinity of integrable solutions. So this is sort of a more horrible setting, but, you know, that's the way it is. We expect from our experience in classical chaos, and, you know, Goodschuller kind of theory, that there will be exponentially many unstable solutions. And now these are not just, you know, configurations of two electrons, but these are patterns in space-time. So unstable, different kinds of solutions that we are supposed to count. And we also have no reason in the world whatsoever to expect that anything can be done analytically. You know, so this is going to be... There are theoretical issues where the thing works, but, you know, if it works, then the work is going to be really grunge. I mean, there will be lots of numerical work to do. Now, what we have today in this program, so I'll just tell you a few things that at least I know so far, is I've marked in green sort of classical things, and in red kind of quantum things. I guess this is, well, this is really classical. And what I'll try to describe briefly in this talk is, you know, what do we learn from very simple field theories? So, you know, we'll, instead of looking at quantum mechanics, we'll look at one space, one time field theory, it means a partial differential equation. And, you know, the experience in studying classical dynamics tells us that dissipative systems might be easier to work with at the starting point. So I'll describe one such system which is dissipative, meaning that it has a tractor and it's, you know, finite dimensional. Then I'll tell you, you know, the difficulties we encounter finding spatiotemporal recurrences in these systems, and, you know, ideas that have been tried and they're still under development how to do this. And then I'll probably skip this, but I would like to hear from you. You know, in quantum field theory, we'll have to look at infinite dimensional Hamiltonian flows, and we don't actually have very good ideas today even how to look at high but finite dimensional Hamiltonian flows of this kind. On the quantum side, what, you know, people have done so far is to, well, there's some, you know, direct sort of quantum work, but what has been rather fruitful is to say that, you know, noisy dynamics, so stochastic processes share many features together with quantum mechanics. So, you know, instead of Schrödinger, you look at Langevin or Fokker-Planck of some kind. And, you know, start learning how you compute these corrections. And what we sort of know is, you know, we have developed a number of methods, you know. Some are classical, some are just Feynman diagrammatic methods, you know, adopted to this setting. Then I'll describe to you something which I find very beautiful, which is, you know, marrying Feynman and Poincaré. And then I'll mention the one that works best, which is not so beautiful, but it just works much better than anything else. And the things that are left hanging at this time in these ideas is that we don't really know, you know, how gauge invariance and such things that are very important in field theories, you know, how it's going to be used here. And we have some ideas about renormalization of kind that say, oh, we know how to do it, but I'm not quite sure we do know how to do it. So this is all, you know, open. Now, because we're in California, I asked my friend, friends, Californian friends, to give me title for the slides. So the next one is Californian title. So we go with the flow. I mean, the idea is we want to find the simplest field theory which has a market, you know, because of course you can pull out 1 zillion field theories out of hat and, you know, nobody cares. So we try to find something that made sense to lots of people, even if it doesn't make sense to everybody. So there's a desiderata where in picking the models to work with, to find something that's, you know, not zero-dimensional theory, but it has real spatial patterns. And, you know, we pick one dimension for the start, not to, you know, kill ourselves with various spinorial and vectorial, blah, blah, blah. We first would like to do a scalar field theory. The field theory should have some kind of parameter which drives it from, you know, what you understand to what you don't understand. So from, you know, some kind of regular behavior to turbulent behavior. And, you know, to avoid ulcers at this stage, you know, you would like it to be ultraviolet finite, meaning it doesn't have very kinky solutions. And you would like it to be infrared finite. And, you know, we do this dissipation, takes care of this, and compact support for the theory will take care of that. And then you go around and you talk to your colleagues who care about, you know, spatio-temporal systems and find out what's most popular. So the general setting is, you know, they have partial differential equation, but there's some kind of field which has time evolution given by a linear part in field and derivatives of field and a nonlinear part. And then, you know, what do people like? They like nonlinear Schrodinger equations. So these are all very honorable, you know, models used in many situations. Berger's equation is good, you know, complex Ginzburg-Landau is used by lots of people, and Kuramoto-Shivashinsky. And we have sort of picked out these two as they seem like the simplest to do. So this is sort of picking out a model in which you would like to test the ideas. Now, what are the ideas? So now I'll try to explain the title, talk of the title. So the idea is that, and it's kind of very, you know, visual and human idea, that when you talk to specialists in turbulence, not the engineers, but the physicists, then they tell you the following thing. No, I mean, they're you know, different sets of people. They tell you the following thing. The interesting problem is homogeneous turbulence. And somebody wrote the poem that there are worlds within worlds within worlds. And there is a Kolmogorov exponent. It's brilliant. We have to compute corrections to Kolmogorov exponent. So that's one approach. Now, the problem is this approach, you know, I find the field theory involved is very beautiful and I have great respect for it. The problem is that to me, turbulence doesn't look like that. I mean, you know, I don't know. Nobody can usually show me an experiment where, you know, I can see that there are no scales, you know, that something is, there are structures on all scales down to dissipation scale. Usually what happens is you look up and you see clouds and you say, huh, these are clouds. Then somebody shows you a picture and you say, you know, this is surface of the sun. And if you have a good graduate student doing some experiment, they show you some worldly picture like this one, he says, well, you know, the current was probably 1.7 milliamps. Now, how do people know this? You know, because the main thing about turbulence is that you never see the same thing twice. But what you do see is you see, you know, characteristic patterns that at least your visual cortex kind of pulls out. So, you know, to me, turbulence is some kind of walk-in. Now, this has been ascribed to Hopf because this is a gentleman, one of the two gentlemen long dead, and, you know, he cannot protest. The way to think about turbulent classical dynamics, forget about quantum problems right now, is that you have some partial differential equation, let's say some kind of Navier-Stokes in some conditions or magnetohydrodynamics or something, and you have boundary conditions and you have parameters, and it's that system you're looking at. And that system is very specific. It has some repertoire of patterns that it explores. So even though in principle any function can be fed in, you know, fed into its initial condition in partial differential equations, the dynamics, you know, selects them. And actually, even though this is an infinite dimensional space of all possible patterns, it's probably a rather large space. I mean, a rather small space. And the reason why I tend to believe it's rather small is because it's recognizable. So the thing is, to some, you know, finite accuracy in space and time, if I put some kind of grid and I, you know, blur it a little bit, I'll find in my either experimental or numerical temporal evolution of some turbulent system recurrences of the same pattern. So the one approach to the theory which I'll use here is to say not that turbulence is statistical, there'll be no statistics of any kind, nothing probabilistic. It'll be that it say that it explores some space of patterns, and to any given finite resolution, that's a finite space, and I'm supposed to find what that alphabet is and what the dynamics in this alphabet is. So this is really transplanting the, you know, ergodic theory of low-dimensional systems onto partial differential equations. Okay, so now to make it more concrete, you know, we picked one of the problems with Crick was a sort of burning flame front, or Kuramoto-Shivashinsky. So this is the problem, you know, you can think of it, a Bunsen burner, and, you know, people actually, this whole industry, real industry of real combustion involved this kind of equations. So you have something that has a finite support, and the thing is burning, and depending how much you screw up the velocity of the gas or a fraction of oxygen or something, the thing becomes unstable. This is totally empirical, you know, this we understand. You know, it's turbulent in some sense. I mean, the pattern never shows up. And now you sit down and you start writing credible equations as a chemist or physicist or something for what the height or the velocity of this rant is. And this has been done by Kuramoto-Shivashinsky, and the work has been done, you know, together with my students Putkaradze and Christiansen quite a while ago, the initial work. And basically, you know, equation says that it's nonlinear, so it cares about, you know, if it's strong field, you get an U square here. So it cares about this stuff. There is diffusion. It turns out that's not quite enough. So one sort of sticks in a super diffusion, some factor. And you pay penalty for having a kinky front. So if you start with some very irregular front, the dynamics will like to smooth it out, and this controls it, this sort of viscosity parameter. Then you put it on a computer, and there is a, yeah, I can go through this, you can make it plus. I mean, there is some symmetry and you change U to minus U, etc. And it actually, this sign actually can be talked away. But your question is absolutely right, always. So it just turns out that, you know, when you look at the professional literature, they write it in this form. There are two forms in which they like to write. And I'm just following the masters in this. What? Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, that's the way to think about it, that this, you know, when you do linear analysis, which I will not do here because, you know, it's kind of peripheral to this talk, when you say one solution that looks reasonable to me, so the literature usually does, this says U equals zero solution. We can all see that U equals zero solution, right? Then we do linear analysis of it. Now, that's good because U square derivative of it is still zero. So then linear analysis says I draw some kind of quartic curve. And then depending on what's either mu, if you have finite size of the burner, or if you increase the burner but keep the viscosity the same, you find out that there are lots of unstable modes. So you find out that, you know, when you have a flat thing, it likes to fall apart in 2 wiggles, 3 wiggles, you know, up to 17 wiggles or something. Now, the problem with this analysis is that actual dynamics doesn't care about this because empirically you know that if you start with some turbulent front or something, you know, on the surface sun, even though in principle it could become flat, it never does, you know. So the recurrence that everything, you know, dies out and it's totally flat solution doesn't happen. So actually the dynamics turns out to be very far away from where this analysis is done, but it's still not bad. But I don't want to, you know, go into many details here. I just want to say, you know, you can put it on a computer, and putting it on a computer means that either you digitize the space in some way and, you know, put some clever derivatives, Or you say, well, you know, this is periodic in space, so let me do it in Fourier space. So people know how to do this very well. And, you know, the important sort of information for us is that there is a theorem that says, and it's kind of intuitive, but it's, you know, it's also official. It says that if there is some hyperviscosity, so if this number exists, is not zero, then a tractor is finite dimensional. So that means no matter where you start in the function space, eventually dynamics will be something that can be described with a finite number of dimensions. You know, it could be 1,000, but it's finite dimensional. And then very qualitative, if the viscosity parameter is strong, so larger than one in this form of the equation, every initial condition dies, you know, everything flattens out, so it's boring dynamics. If it's smaller than one, but not much smaller than one, in some sense, then what happens is that, and I'll show you examples of it, the thing is turbulent, but when you look at it carefully, it's turbulence on very small scales. So it turns out the tractor is, you know, barely bigger than one dimension. And then if the viscosity is much smaller than one, the thing is extremely unstable. And, you know, there are all kinds of phenomenological ideas, you know, what's the dimension of the attractor, etc. Now, this turns out to be not very difficult for most applied math people who work on this, but it's, you'll see it's very difficult for us, for a reason I'll explain pretty soon. But the way that these partial differential equations are always solved is, you know, we make a finite set of something because we stick them on a computer. And, you know, more or less intelligent, depending how much you understand about nature of solutions, you choose better basis or basis set or something. But, you know, no interesting work can be done in less than, let's say, 15 dimensions. And people do it in 1,000 dimensions. And, you know, when they do Navier-Stokes, it gets, you know, truly amazing because they do non-trivial work in, you know, in millions of dimensions. But this is already very difficult for us. Now, a typical solution looks something like that. So here is one solution. And I will make a confession at the end of the talk. This is not a very nice picture, but on, you know, my homepage, they're much better ones. So typical solution says that, you know, the field, you chose it to be around zero by, you know, some logic early in the discussion. And what happens is that for some viscosity not much smaller than one, the solution just wiggles. So you look at it and it seems to like to have, you know, three or five wiggles, and they're nonlinear, you know, they go around and something goes on. And I could show you very beautiful pictures, but not today. And now, so when you look at spatial pictures, you know, it just looks like one of those things that show you on covers of reputable journals, you know, color graphics, because you can, you know, color code this stuff. Now, and then you look at it in Fourier space, you're less impressed. So the same, exactly same dynamics done, not in coordinates around the ring, but in a Fourier mode, you find out that, you know, it's actually not a big deal. I mean, what's going on is that there's some unstable chaotic solution, and, you know, it's not much more impressive than Lorentz or Rosslare or something. It's just that you're actually doing very accurate computation. This is not some crude model saying that, you know, qualitatively looks like this. You're actually solving this equation in the sense that, you know, when we do our calculation, it's accurate to 10 to the minus 11, you know. So it's absurdly accurate for some reasons that, you know, we like having to do with zeta functions and convergence of the theory, but no experimentalists would care about. So in this particular program, so now, you know, what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to find a simple field theory where I can do something and just check out Hopf's idea. Now, Hopf's idea is that you look for recurrent patterns. And what we now do is, in this particular model and, you know, in this simple setting, we find thousands of them. So, you know, and we, in some sense, it's not a theorem, it's not rigorous, but it's kind of rather credible for physicists. We, you know, can reassure you that we have found all spatial temporally periodic solution of this burning flame front up to time 1,000, where the shortest periodic orbit is, you know, 3 or 1 or something like that. Maybe 1,000 is exaggeration, but, you know, we find thousands of solutions, and we can now compute, using those solutions, we can compute things like correlations on a burning front or some kind of transport or Lyapunov exponents, whatever you like. Now, in the initial investigation, it was very unclear, and it's still unclear today, even though we have gone deeper into this, whether when turbulence gets strong, this is an intelligent way to think about it. Because what you discover by doing this kind of spatiotemporal chaos is that it works in a way we already used to, because the classical chaos works pretty well. And the hope is that, you know, the stuff that we uncover persists into deep turbulent regime, and it helps us organize the recurrent patterns that you see in a turbulent regime. Now I'll digress a little bit, but it's very important to us, and, you know, maybe you have some ideas. And the question is the following. What we actually have to do, we have to find periodic solutions of partial differential equations. So we have to find, you know, morally equations, periodic solutions embedded in infinite dimensional space. And this turns out to be very hard. And even though, you know, people who solve these equations numerically, they tend to just run everything forward in time. If you use methods that are developed for periodic orbits in low dimensions, which are typically Newton methods or similar thing, Newton-Raphson methods, they require that one computes stability of this flow, inverts this matrix, et cetera, and keeps working. Now, this kills us. So basically what happens to us is, you know, when a workstation has run for a week and still hasn't inverted the matrix, we stop. And, you know, there might be good ideas, but here is one that we are exploring, and it looks so elementary that I would very much be surprised that it doesn't exist in literature, but I can't find it. So here is an elementary idea. The problem is that when you are in 15 to 1,000 dimensions, you have no clue what anything looks like. I mean, you can look at it in two- and three-dimensional projection, and it just looks like some messy trajectory. If you run system for a time, you just get something gray projected, you know, on your retina. So, you know, so how do you find anything in this kind of space? Now, if you sort of make some guess, it's actually rather hard to make a guess. You know, you have 1,000 coordinates. You have to find a point in 1,000 coordinates to come back after some time. This is rather hard to do. So one thing you could do is you could be very conservative. And you can actually guess not one point, but you can guess an entire loop of points. Now, that seems stupid because now you need 1,000 times 1,000 points, you know, to keep track of. But if you require that loop is smooth, you know that your vector field that defines the flow is smooth. If you require that loop is smooth, you know, it's very hard to destroy this. So the idea is that if you can establish some kind of flow in space of loops, so you make some, you know, rather uninformed guess, you say, in three dimensions, I just write a circle, then what happens? But if you could find some flow which, you know, was very robust and it just kept straightening all the parts of the flow, and if this thing ended up in periodic orbit, you know, you could maybe isolate few short orbits topologically and, you know, start from there in space. So the sad thing is that I guess something. I have to define a flow in space of loops. And what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to end at infinite time, at a periodic orbit, which has the property that the tangent field of this loop agrees with the given vector field, which is my equations of motion. And this is in rather high dimensions, and I require periodicity. Now, if I start with a loop, you know, periodicity is imposed. So if you want to, this is the extreme version of multi-shooting. Instead of, you know, shooting three times around an orbit and trying to guess, you, every infinitesimal step, you shoot and you work. So now what we did was the simplest thing, and it turns out to be some kind of paranoid version of Newton method, where you're so paranoid that you make, instead of jumping, you know, to the better solution, you make infinitesimal step every time you compute the derivative. So what we did is, but you know, it's easier to describe it in terms of variation principle. We start with some loop, and this loop is wrong any place, because every place I check, the real vector field is not tangential to this loop. So now here, my tangent, which is my arbitrary loop, is my arbitrary parameterization, you know, in some variable s, points this way. The real field is pointing someplace else in 1,000 dimensions. But if I could minimize this function, which says the my fake loop's tangent field versus the real vector field in the space times the conversion factor that makes sure that they have the same length. If I could do this, you know, I square this, compute it on a loop, if I can drive this to zero, I'll do very well. Now, it turns out, you know, on very simple reasoning, you can do this. Basically, if you do a variation of this thing, and you require that the fictitious flow is changing all the points on the loop in such a way that change is proportional to the minus of the error, and now this is error in, you know, 1,000 dimensions, then you can see that this thing will descend. And what you have to do is you have to solve a partial, you have to, you know, solve a double partial differential equations. You have to solve things having to do about motion along the loop, then, you know, motion transverse to the loop, then the stability, you know, matrix of variation of the real flow, the thing that goes into Jacobian of the real flow. Then, you know, you have to adjust your velocity parameter so that eventually the time unit is correct. So if you can solve this equation, this thing actually is, it's very easy to show that at time tau, fictitious time tau, this is exponentially small compared to your error. So now we have been doing this, and this is very painful, and I'll be very grateful for any improvements and suggestions. But basically what it does is, you know, you totally stupidly take your very turbulent system, you draw some curve, you use a graduate student to do this because it's a very painful thing to do, you know, because you have to define lots of coordinates, and the thing runs and eventually gets very close to the true solution, and then you can stick some kind of Newton method if you want to. And you find few of them, and you start developing an idea, you know, what the short recurrent patterns are in this large space. And if you're successful, this should be very robust. And please give me some comments, because now I'll switch gears. Does this look familiar? It's not gradient descent, and it's not, you know, contra-gradient descent. It's none of the things in numerical recipes book. God, first I'm amazed there's so many people, the other one is just so quiet, but okay. Having solved the problem of turbulence, we are now ready to move on to the real problem, which is the quantum problem. So, you know, so I have this very good graduate student, and now he has solved this problem, so what he wants to know what to do next. Well, there is one thing that I'm a little bit fuzzy about myself, because it's very easy to work with these model systems which are dissipative, you know, things like Navier-Stokes and equations that have finite dimensional attractors. Now, this is not going to be true in systems which you care about. You know, Hamiltonian dynamics is not like that. And I don't have a very good idea about how this is going to work when I actually have, you know, in zeroth order approximation, which is supposed to avoid infinitely many harmonic oscillators, but, you know, this is going to get chaotic and turbulent. So if you have some ideas, I would be very grateful. Now here comes my second title from my friends who are Californian and give me movie titles, so significant corrections. If I've solved the problem of turbulence, I have to now, you know, start putting more quantum mechanics into this. So in the saddle point approximation, what this means is that I replace the, you know, full quantum effective action by a sum of saddles. So locally, the path integral looks like parabolas or something like that. And each one of them picks up stuff that is, you know, semi-classical. And then you have to now also put corrections, because it is not true that locally the stuff is parabolic, you know, has no reason to be that. And that's, you know, what usual quantum field theory does. So when you talk about, you know, magnetic moment of electron running coupling constants, what you're doing is you're putting, you know, the true quantum corrections. Now, this is a little bit too difficult, so our playpen is, you know, embarrassingly simpler than that. We say, well, you know, quantum mechanics is like noise, and noise, you know, we understand a little bit better. But formally, everything looks like, you know, I mean, integrals, you're right, they all look the same, except they don't have eyes in them, so it's not so different. But then we say, look, I mean, it's actually rather difficult to do this for partial differential equations, so let's do it for one-dimensional maps first. And, you know, might not like it, but it's actually quite cute, and you learned quite a bit out of it, and it's totally non-trivial already at this level. So basically, you know, you take some simple system that says the thing is not really Gaussian locally, it's quartic. And, you know, dynamics is not deterministic, it has some width. So there's some, you know, you replace a delta, Dirac delta function dynamics, which is the Perron-Frobenius operator in classical systems, you replace it by something with the width, some Gaussian or cystic noise. And then there is a way to do this, and in more honest quantum calculation, this was actually done by Pierre Gaspar for billiards, but in this kind of models, you know, we have done it, and many other people have done interesting things, like Graham's work and many people. But basically, the standard thing, if you're a trained physicist, you say, well, you know, this is path integral, so I do Feynman diagrams. And so you find that these corrections, the, you know, one-loop, two-loop corrections can be written in terms of one-loop, two-loop Feynman diagrams, except this is, you know, totally horrible compared to what you teach in field theory courses, because the propagator is not translational invariance. It's not some simple thing that you just take a Fourier mode and it says it's 1 over p squared plus m squared. No, it depends on the solution. So the propagator is not translationally invariant. It depends on the saddle you're computing at it. And the vertices are also the same kind. They depend on the, you know, particular quantum saddle. So for every one of these guys, you have different propagators, different saddles, and, you know, they're not tricked to integrate this. There's nothing, you know, there's no Schwinger or Feynman method, because this is kind of real work. Still, we can do it analytically for a while. We can do a few of them analytically. Analytically means that, you know, we can express them in terms of some properties of this dynamics, and then eventually compute something numerically and insert. So, and it took me 3 months to compute first correction, and took us 6 months to compute two-loop corrections. And then something very nice happened, because the next, you know, three-loop correction might have been hard, might have, you know, killed one or two graduate students. A colleague, Ronnie Mainieri, had a good idea, which is kind of Poincaré meets Feynman, and it just looked like voodoo to me. It looked like it wouldn't do anything. And the idea was this, you know, when somebody writes a path integral from this, so, you know, if Kuramoto writes the field theory in Tokyo, or Sivashinsky in Ukraine, they tend to write it in somewhat different ways. And the reason is that, you know, there are infinitely many ways in which you can write the same equations of motion. You know, they're all related by smooth conjugacies. If you have some reason to change coordinates, linearly, non-linearly, you do it, you know. So Poincaré's idea, you know, from celestial mechanics, is to say, well, whenever I have, you know, an orbit I'm interested in, let's do a smooth conjugacy in such a way that we flatten the neighborhood of the orbit. So, you know, we do some kind of normal mode thing, and it's the simplest version of it. You know, I keep only the linear term in some sense. And that, of course, has a finite radius of convergence, but it says this kind of neighborhood of my orbit looks flat. What it means in terms of path integrals is that I replace a nonlinear action by a quadratic action. Now, you know, we are very skilled in doing Gaussian integrals. But there is a price, you know, there is a Jacobian. So my idea was that, okay, you know, what's the big deal? That must be just Feynman integrals. Because, you know, I just rewritten this. And so the way it works is, you know, this is some nonlinear function of fields. So to compute this, you use, let's say, Wick expansion. And, you know, you get something here which is a function. So you have to compute all correlations up to given order between these fields, and you know, you get an answer. Now the answer actually turned out to be very pretty, in the sense that when we were doing perturbative calculations, we were very puzzled. Like, we felt we were missing some symmetries, because we would, you know, fill out pages and pages of these Feynman diagrams, which are not translationally invariant, not rotationally invariant, nothing good about them, and the result was simple. You know, you add them all up, and something very simple happened. And in this situation, the result just came out. So, you know, first two orders, you did a relatively simple calculation, the result came out. And, you know, I find this very suggestive, because we never do this in field theory. We never try to find, unless we are trying to, you know, show that it's an integral model, we never try to find an intelligent nonlinear transformation such that actually the answer makes sense. We just, you know, work at it. This is an example where a smooth conjugacy and, you know, a totally reasonable thing, saying that in neighborhood of the saddle, I make it trivial, I make it Gaussian exactly, I get a rather simpler and rather pretty thing. Now, I have to report, you know, I love this as a theorist, but then Carl Detman, Gabor Vata, Carl Detman, etc. In this case, the method was invented by various people, including Vata, but if you, instead of that, go to an explicit basis, so it's like, you know, solving Schrodinger equation in a basis, you know, termion wave functions. Usually tells you nothing, but yeah, there it is. So you have evolution operators, so, you know, e to the action, if you wish, or Hamiltonian of the system. You replace it by its representation in some specific basis. In this case, the basis is very simple. It's really just Taylor expansion and Laurent expansion. So it's actually very simple. And all the stuff is on my homepage, by the way, and in very painful, huge detail. There's three papers describing this. And what Carl Detman, who is now in Bristol, did is he used this method and he computed first 56 H-bar corrections. So, you know, I cannot even conceive how you would do this by Feynman. I mean, it's just inconceivable, because Feynman diagrams go like n to the n factorial. And I don't know what's the growth rate for this method. But, you know, the simple method of putting bigger and bigger matrices on computer and just computing, it works extremely well. So that's the result so far. And I have to make a confession. If you haven't seen enough pictures and beautiful formulas, is what happened is we had a faculty meeting, and then I had to rush out of the faculty meeting, grab my transparencies, go to the airport, get here, and I discovered I brought wrong transparencies. I don't have my chalk at all. So I just had to do this morning. But this work, again, a Hollywood title for translation of semi-classical methods, work on these somewhat classical methods was performed by Detman, who did amazing work, actually, and has double N in his name. Ronny Mainieri, who had the Poincaré idea, Vata, who had many ideas, including this basis idea, myself, and then, you know, many students have sharpened, are still sharpening their teeth on this. So the partial differential equation, Kormotov-Shivashinsky, was done by Christiansen Putkaradze. The high orders in the theory were done by Polner and Sonnegaard. And currently, Lan is, you know, developing this variational methods, and Pascal Uskas at Georgia Tech is developing Hamiltonian version of the theory. And now we have lots of time for questions, right? And what I really need is help, because, you know, I want to find out, somebody knows about this variational method. Somebody must have thought about high-dimensional Hamiltonian systems.
All right, are there any questions, please?
You know, it's just kind of somewhat arbitrary. We did not do burgers. I mean, but Kuramoto-Shirashinsky is just the equation I wrote you. So, you know, and you know, it has this miraculous, doesn't matter. I mean, it's just another equation, and I can't say anything else about it except, you know, lots of people have intuition about bifurcations and parameter space regions, and you know, so we rely on them. There's lots of beautiful work, numerical work and theoretical work, and that's why we picked it, you know, because we don't know about PDAs, at least I don't know about PDAs. Yes.
And wondering what is being assumed in that smoothing out of the transverse space in ordinary Hamiltonian mechanics. I would guess that that would work if you don't have any bifurcations.
Yeah. No, you know, generically, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, usually this is just zeroth order of normal form theory. So generically what happens is that if you happen to be close to bifurcation, in which case everything has to change because I have to change the trace formula, I have to do this and that. If I'm close to, you know, then I have to use a normal form, which is appropriate. But in the ergodic system, you know, almost everybody, you know, exponentially many things, and if you were rigorous and could prove it, everybody can be flattened out locally because everybody is just, has no marginal eigenvalues. You're not close to bifurcation. But, you know, you're putting your finger on a painful spot because, for example, when I talk to you about variational method, you know, it doesn't take you much to figure out that there is a marginal eigenvalue along the direction of periodic orbit, you know. So some good idea has to have to do with, you know, it's really like a gauge invariance. You have totally free parameterization along the orbit, and you're trying to transversely flow to it. And we do it in somewhat brutal way, which I don't like, which is we use one Poincaré section to make it transverse. But, you know, I don't like that. But so all applications of that kind. Now, in Hamiltonian cases, most of the stuff will be elliptic because, you know, I'm in many dimensions. It's very unlikely that everybody is hyperbolic, especially infinitely many things. So, you know, how are we going to put this together? I would very much like to be told how to do this.
Yes.
Naturally led to things instead of having to have patches on the patches. Feynman had us considered that when we're exploring something, we're usually right about some aspects of it and wrong about others. So he says, a good way to get a clue is to look where you're putting the patches. One way to think about where the patches went in 20th century was they went for the discrete spaces and the continuous spaces were different. But those are the places where the patches kept coming up. And so the idea is if you look at...
Excuse me, could we keep the questions a little shorter, please?
Okay. Anyway.
No, we'll meet afterwards because I'd like to hear. And because I have this podium, you know, I can now monopolize a little bit. I have a strong feelings on the matter that you just said. And, you know, they come up again as a new kind of science. But the what has happened to me, I worked very hard on cellular automata, and I never published a single thing. Because my experience in discretization of that kind has always been that it's much, much richer problem than the problem that has differential and smooth structure. So I've sort of given up on discrete spaces. I use them only as numerical aids.
I'd like to ask a question myself. Yeah. I would have assumed, I know nothing about applications of semi-classical theory in field theory. But
nobody does.
I would assume that that finding bound state solutions would be the easiest problem, ground states. And I don't see why it shouldn't be possible to make a good estimate of mass of a proton or something from standard QCD and so on. What is the status of this question?
The best work is done on lattices, so it's done on four-dimensional crystals, and the problem is that it's extremely hard to put fermions. It's extremely hard to put representation of SO4 onto a square lattice.
But why can't you just look for a fixed point of the classical system?
I mean, that's, you know, what they do, and they have credible spectrum of various masses. And in this way, I agree with you, what, you know, you would be finding the spectrum of color singlets. So the first thing would look like some kind of pion mass. I agree with you. I mean, it would have to be done like that. You know, we are like light years away from being able to do this calculation. It's somehow very different. You know, Monte Carlo just says, you know, this is a massive thing. And then I do this four-dimensional integral. This, you literally do that path integral. And you run into lots of problems which have to do with fermions. I mean, fermions just don't sit on a four-dimensional lattice. They sit in continuum, you know. And you know, there is the best answer, but I'm not happy. I mean, what can I say? I don't like it. And I might be wrong.
Are there any more questions? Yes.
Do you have a model that is simple enough that you know some quantum fields?
No.
Theory,
no.
So you know some answer from somewhere else
that
you
could plug in to do
to go the inverse way, which you can do in quantum cables or plug-in eigenvalues
and find very obvious. No, it's very different because here the quantum theory is not solved. It's very different from hydrogen in external electric field. Yeah. So now it's harder. And it might never work, but you know, I have tenure, so what can I say? I have to do what a man has to do. I mean, what? But it's not simple. Yeah.
Are there any more questions? Let's thank our speaker. Again. Paul, our next speaker will be Paul Brummer, who will be telling us about.